In a recent New York Times interview, novelist Russell Banks said he comes from people who viewed success as a criticism of their life. Moving up and into the world of ideas was a betrayal. Russell Banks has moved away from his working-class New England background, but he keeps returning in his fiction. Banks' new novel, Affliction, deals with a recurring theme in his work, male violence. Affliction is a portrait of two sons of an abusive, alcoholic father. Banks says he's trying to understand the consequences of having been beaten by his father. The novel asks if it's possible to break the chain of male violence. Banks grew up in Barnstead, New Hampshire. His father was a plumber, his grandfather was a plumber, and in the early 60s, he was a plumber too. In a review of Banks' previous novel, Continental Drift, James Atlas wrote that Banks' ability to evoke the texture of American life rivals John Updike's. The new novel, Affliction, is narrated by Rolf Whitehouse, who tells the story of how his brother Wade turned into a man even more violent than their father. Rolf says he is telling his brother's story because it is Rolf's ghost life, and he wants to exorcise it. I asked Russell Banks if writing the novel was a kind of exorcism for him.
I think so. I guess I won't really know for another couple of years when if I find myself driven to come back to the same story in some way again, because I've tried to tell the story a number of ways, a number of times over the years, and I think I finally got it told. The story being, the story of domestic violence and that context for a life, family life, and also the story being the story of the perpetrator rather than that of simply and narrowly the victim, which I think is only half the story.
Mm-hmm.
The whole story isn't really told, I don't think, until you can tell it from the point of view, or at least until you can enter the mind of the perpetrator, or of the oppressor, I guess. Because it's so systemic, it's part of a larger system than just a good guy versus a bad guy.
I'd like you to do a reading from Affliction, and this is a scene in which the father who beats his wife and his children is confronting his son, and the son has to figure out what to do. And this is the older son in the book, Wade.
Yeah, Wade is the protagonist really of the novel, and we're dealing with him as an adult for the most part, for 2 weeks in his life really. But this scene, and it takes place when he's about 16 years old, it's really his part of his essential childhood. He's tried to confront his father in the middle of a quarrel between his father and mother, and the father says, "You're telling me. You are trying to tell me what I'm supposed to be afraid of? You think I'm afraid of you?" He showed his large teeth and made a quick move toward Wade. And when Wade jumped, he stopped and folded his arms over his chest and laughed. "Jesus H. Christ," he said. "What a candy ass." Without thinking it, Wade reached behind him into the dish rack, and his hand wrapped itself as if of its own volition around the handle of the skillet, heavy black cast iron, and he lifted it free of the rack and swung it around in front of him. The sound of his heart pounded in his ears like a hammer against steel, and he heard his voice, high and thin in the distance, say to his father, "If you touch her or me or any of us again, I'll kill you." His father quietly said, "Jesus." He sounded like a man who had just broken a shoelace. "I mean it, I'll kill you." He lifted the skillet in his right hand and held it out and just off his shoulder like a ping-pong paddle, and he suddenly felt ridiculous. Without hesitation, Pop walked quickly around the table, came up to his son and punched him straight in the face, sending the boy careening back against the counter and the skillet to the floor. Grabbing him by his shirt front, Pop hauled the boy back in front of him and punched him a second time and a third. A fourth blow caught him square in the forehead and propelled him along the counter to the corner of the room where he stood with his hands covering his face. "Come on," his father said, and he advanced on him again. "Come on, fight back like a man. Come on, little boy, let's see what you're made of." Wade yanked his hands away and thrust his face open-eyed at his father and cried, "I'm not made of what you're made of," and Pop hit him again, slamming Wade's head back against the wall. Wade covered his face with his hands once more, and he began to cry. Pop turned away in disgust. "You sure ain't," he said, and he walked over to the door, where he turned back to Wade and said, "Next time you start telling your father what to do and what not to do, make damn sure you can back it up, buddy boy." Then he went out, slamming the door behind him. Wade let himself slide slowly down to the floor, where he sat with his legs straight out, his head slumped on one shoulder, his arms flopped across his lap, a marionette with its strings cut.
Well, it's a terrific scene. You know, the two brothers in this book, one of them, Wade, who is in the scene that you just read, decides to fight back at some point, whereas his other brother, his younger brother, Rolf, learns to hang his head in shame and back away, something he learned from his mother. When you were growing up in a family with an abusive father, did that seem like the two alternatives, to hang your head in shame and back away, or to learn how to fight back?
Yeah, I think that, for a boy, that's certainly the two alternatives, because you can imagine, and you internalize early and then later put into action that fantasy of revenge, of fighting back. And Wade's taken that route, despite its destructiveness in his life. And then, or you can run. You can be the denier, in a sense. You can cut yourself off from others and remove yourself from family or community and all forms of intimacy, like Rolf, the narrator of the book.
Which did you do?
Well, in a sense, I did both, I think, at different stages of my life. When I was very young, I mean, when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and so on, I was one of those turbulent, violent young men, always on the edge of exploding, and oftentimes actually exploding, a barroom brawler kind of person that society has kind of mixed feelings about. On the one hand, he's often attractive and the hero of a lot of films and television specials and so forth. On the other hand, he's a repugnant and a chaotic individual. And then later, I think I went through a period of my life where I was distanced and detached and protected myself and protected others through that.
Mm-hmm. Novelist Russell Banks is my guest, and we're talking about his new novel, Affliction. Is the scene that you just read a scene from personal experience?
Well, to some degree. In terms of the boy wanting to defend his mother and understanding his role in the family as that was certainly something that I experienced emotionally and situationally, not necessarily at the same age or exactly the same circumstances. And then failing to be a man, as it were, in those terms that the father was defining, to rise to that occasion, failing to become that person. So that's the essence of that scene, is that the challenge is thrown down, be a man, and to be a man he's got to fight him, and not be a victim, not just be beaten by him.
So was there a point in your life when you figured out that there was another way to define manhood?
Surely. I think that, you know, I think one knows these things, and you don't have to figure them out. It's pretty apparent what's good and what's bad behavior. But there are powerful compulsions that grow out of this situation, this context of a child's life. And the compulsions get enacted despite what you've figured out and what you know. And that's where the pain and shame come into it. Because men who beat their wives, no matter how much it gets reinforced by the society at large, nevertheless know that it's wrong, and what they're acting out of is some strange and powerful compulsion.
Rolf, the brother who withdraws, says at one point, "I became a careful adult. It may have been a high price to pay, never having been carefree, but at least I avoided being afflicted by the man's violence." But he kind of comes to realize that there's other kinds of affliction from this violence, too.
That's
which
right.
is the knowledge that you're withdrawing from life to protect
That's
yourself.
Right.
And I was wondering at what point you started to realize that, and also to fear this kind of deeper affliction, that it's something that you would carry, that in a way someone who came from an abusive family might mm-hmm. be something of a time bomb themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Rolf is sort of whistling in the dark there in the passage you quoted. And part of his telling of the story is a way of his realizing that he is whistling in the dark, so that the last lines of the book, in a way, are his gradual admission that that he's still locked in some way. And that's certainly the first step toward perhaps release from the situation. My own case, it's hard to say. This is a process and a lifelong one. I've been writing about these kind of men and boys for most of my career in one way or the other, most of the time, and I think less so now, indirectly and obliquely. But as my own emotional life has become a little bit less tangled and turbulent and conflicted, I've been able, as a writer, to approach the characters and the world that they live in more directly. You want to go a little further on it? Because I wanted to say that as a novelist, I have I have access to certain tools and strategies, I guess, for lack of a better word, that perhaps a person normally doesn't have, just because, for instance, memory is a novelist tool that has to be cultivated and preserved. And so I'm forced again and again through that to go back to my own childhood. The language of fiction ends up eventually betraying you if you aren't telling the truth, and so is my attention to my craft and attention to language has forced me to perhaps, to deal with the truth of the matter more than I might have otherwise if I were, if I ran a used car lot or if I were a lawyer or something.
I want to ask you about the narration, the way
right.
you chose the narrative structure for the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of complicated narrative structure in the sense that it's narrated by the withdrawn brother
mm-hmm.
who's telling the story of his older brother, the brother mm-hmm. who becomes violent himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the story we're reading is primarily the story of the older brother as told
yeah.
by the younger brother, but we sometimes almost forget that the younger brother's telling it because
right.
we're seeing it so much through the eyes of the older brother. Surely there would have been a simpler way
well,
of telling it. Tell me why
yeah.
you chose this kind of
Well, it might
structure.
Have been a simpler way, but then it might have also misled or misrepresented the, I should say, and anyway, any other way to tell the story wouldn't have been able for me to have told the story. I told it this way because the particular story seemed to demand it. It's not as complicated as it might seem. Partially, I think we're in a way, over the last decade or so, as readers in America anyhow, have been seduced by the power and brilliance of a lot of writers' work, mostly what are generally called minimalist writers, into a fairly simplistic idea of what a narrator is or can do. And we've forgotten that the tradition of realism in fiction is much wider than that, and my narrator is essentially the same kind of narrator that Melville uses in Bartleby the Scrivener. It's a guy telling a story about another person, and in the process of telling a story about this other person, comes to a deeper understanding of himself and his connections to the other person.
You know, by writing a novel that everyone will assume is at least partly autobiographical about family abuse, domestic abuse, you know that when you're interviewed, you're going to be asked about how much is autobiographical and about violence in your family and everything. And I'm wondering if when you decided to do interviews about the book,
mm-hmm.
if you felt comfortable with that.
Well,
especially with us interviewers,
yeah.
you know, we always try to make connections between the
right.
life and the work. And, I don't know if you feel like
mm-hmm.
just because you're writing this book that you have to come clean about everything that's
yeah.
happened in your life. Go
no,
public
I don't.
About
and I, believe me, I won't.
Right, yeah, right.
But I think that, yes, I know that even if you write a book that's about Martians, people will ask you about that connection between the author and the fictional characters and so forth. And the standard response is, I think, the reasonable one, which is there's no connection whatsoever. I just made it up, as it were. But And I know, though, with a novel like this and so forth, it's more likely to invite it. I have gone ahead and acknowledged in numerous places that there are real connections between my own childhood experience and the experience of Wade Whitehouse and Rolf Whitehouse for a couple of reasons, when I would just as soon, frankly, say no, none whatsoever. I just, you know, read about it in the papers. I guess because I think, and this in some ways separates me as a writer from the book, and just talks about it. I don't want to talk about it then, just as a man who happened to come up in a family that was marked by violence. I think that it's probably a useful thing to do, to come out and say it and admit it and say that, yeah, this happened to me, and I went through a long period of my life where I was ashamed, and that the shame is one of the ways in which you continue that syndrome, and the loneliness and alienation that you feel because of it is one of the ways in which it perpetuates itself. So by speaking of it and conceding that, you know, this occurred in my life, I think I'm also in some way contributing to breaking down that syndrome a little bit. I think if more of us did it, I mean, these things, afflictions of this sort, sexual abuse, violent domination of people by each other in a family and so forth, are perpetuated and fed by secrecy and silence. So I don't know how else I could respond to the questions without saying, yeah, you're right, it did happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't die, you know. And it caused a great deal of pain and confusion in my life and in the life of people close to me. But in time, I managed to, I think, break that syndrome.
Unlike the father in your novel who outlives the mother, your father left the family when you were 12. Do you feel in a way lucky that he did, so that you and your mother were no longer exposed to his violence?
Well, certainly when you remove the key figure in the family, you break the syndrome, but you also break all other kinds of relationship down in a way. When he left, we also lost our father, and lots of other aspects to his life were gone from our life, and so we then became, my mother in a sense became one of these single parents with four small children. I was the oldest at 12, and so there were other kinds of consequences. So I couldn't say it was a good thing. What happened, I think, was just a dysfunctional family became dysfunctional in another way at 12. My relationship with my father had a blank that went from age 12 to about 18 when I reestablished contact with him and reconnected to him and spent the next decade or so of my life in some ways trying to come to know him and to know myself in his world. And so I wasn't, you know, without a father.
I want to read a sentence from your novel that I particularly like. Wade was the third child in a taciturn family that left children early to their own devices, as if there were nothing coming in adult life worth preparing them for.
Hmm.
Is that the kind of upbringing you felt you had? I like the sentence a lot. I like the way you describe that.
I don't think that I had that kind of upbringing altogether, no. No, that's a little grimmer than I had. I think, though, I'm taking something that I know firsthand to some degree and also having witnessed it in other lives. I'm talking about lives with low expectations and people who, in a sense, don't respect their childhood because they don't believe that their lives can ever amount to anything anyhow.
The novel's set in a small town in New England, and you describe it as the kind of town that people leave but that no one comes back to. And the character who's narrating this describes how he hates to go home on the holidays and that he has to be coerced into it by guilt, tricked, if not by himself, then by the wider sentimental culture.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. And I was wondering what you were thinking of when you were thinking of the wider sentimental culture. You know, and tricking someone like him to go home to this small town he was so happy to escape.
Yeah, I think he says that he especially doesn't like to go home on the holidays. And I think that this, the song, Home for the Holidays, and White Christmas and all our associations with holidays, I think are manipulative and deceitful in some way. They, especially for those of us whose families don't correspond to that family that sits around the loaded board in a kind of golden haze, cheerfully having just opened up all their wonderful Christmas gifts and so forth. The wider sentimental culture seems to obviously creates and perpetuates and then finally exploits a myth of family that doesn't really exist except in, you know, our dreams, and so that most of us go through lives feeling that our families are somehow exceptions and failures, and these cross patches that we spent our childhood are inadequate and shameful failures.
I want to quote something that you said in the recent interview in the New York Times. You said, "I came from a people who viewed success as a criticism of their life. Moving up was a betrayal of the family." How was that expressed to you? I mean, how did you pick up on that?
Well, for instance, my father never understood why it wasn't good enough for me to be a plumber as he had been. And he was a man who felt deeply frustrated and cut off. He was a very bright young boy, and he graduated high school at 16. He was even precocious, had a photographic memory, great musical talent and so forth, loved music. And yet he had spent his life, in the trenches with the wrenches, as he used to say. And so there's a kind of bitterness about that that made it very difficult for him to appreciate my rejection of that. If I reject it, then it has to look somehow not worthwhile to him. And yet he had spent his life in some way rationalizing and accommodating himself to what he felt very bitter about.